You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Benedict Jones.
And I'm Sydney Foreman. This is the WFHB local news for Thursday, October 8th, 2020.
Later in the program, we have an excerpt from last week's episode of Interchange titled Draining the Heartland, Authoritarian Populism in Rural America. WFHB's Brady Haberlin speaks with Mark Edelman, an anthropology professor and affiliate of the Graduate Center at Hunter College in New York City, on the hollowing out of rural America and the rise of authoritarian populism.
Also coming up in the next half hour, WFHB correspondent Aaron Comporti follows up with a story from yesterday about disturbing reports at the Monroe County Correctional Center. But first, your local headlines.
Up first, with your daily coronavirus numbers and other important headlines today, we turn to WFHB correspondent Jake Jacobson, who filed today's local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Thursday, October 8th. I'm Jake Jacobson. 1,488 new cases of COVID-19 were reported in Indiana on Wednesday, according to the Indiana State Department of Health. There were 16 newly reported deaths. Locally, both Monroe and Lawrence counties saw 21 new confirmed cases yesterday. Brown County reported one new case. At the beginning of Wednesday's Bloomington City Council meeting, Council President Steve Volan spoke in support of renaming Jordan Avenue. The comments come in response to an Indiana University Board of Trustees vote to rename three IU campus locations, also named after former Indiana University president and eugenicist David Starr Jordan. Volan proposed renaming the street after Viola and George Taliaferro. Viola served as a judge in Monroe County Court from 1995 to 2004 and was Monroe County's first black judge. Her husband, George, played football at Indiana University and became the first black player drafted into the National Football League in 1949. Monroe County community leaders announced via a joint press release today that a new COVID-19 testing site will be opening later this month. The press release, signed by Mayor John Hamilton, the president of IU Health, Brian Shockney, and members of the Monroe County Health Department and Board of Commissioners, states that the new public testing site will be open through June of 2021. The new testing site will be located in downtown Bloomington and open to the public by appointment. One big factor in establishing the downtown testing site is to make sure public COVID testing is continuously available in Bloomington. Currently, the Indiana Department of Health has contracted OptumServe, who has a public testing site open at the National Guard Armory. However, the state contracts OptumServe on a month-by-month basis. A second site guarantees that Bloomington residents will still have access to public COVID testing when the OptumServe site is eventually decommissioned. More information about the testing site, including the site's exact location and appointment registration, will be shared in the coming weeks. That's all for your local news brief. From WFHB, I'm Jake Jacobson.
Monroe County Commissioners approved general obligation bonds not to exceed $3.1 million for the completion of multiple capital projects during their October 7th meeting. Commissioner Julie Thomas described one amendment to the proposal since its previewing at a September County Council meeting.
This is the one amendment. We have fleet vehicle refresh at $115,000, and these, again, are all estimates that we provide for the public, but the bond itself, it's more flexible. But the decision was made to pay for this van. We're still going to get this van. The YSB needs a new passenger van with an ADA lift. We are still buying this, but we're going to use a different fund through Public Safety Lit. So we're going to have a little bit more money and flexibility with fleet and pool vehicles.
Thomas said other projects include highway department vehicle and equipment upgrades, county passenger vehicles, trail connections, park projects, justice building core switches, office renovations, and sheriff's department equipment.
For the sheriff's department, we have 30 new mobile radios and 38 portable radios. One is in vehicles, the other is what's actually carried on the person, on the deputy. And we have one narcotic analyzer, which will ensure speed, accuracy, and the safety of the deputy.
County Attorney Jeff Cockerell said the county council must approve the bonds before they could be issued.
The Bloomington City Council unanimously approved an ordinance to modify local income tax allocations during their October 7th meeting. City Clerk Nicole Bolden presented the modifications.
Resolution 2014 proposes an ordinance to the Monroe County Local Income Tax Council that would modify the allocation of tax revenues between two components of the local income tax expenditure tax rate. This reallocation will affect the public safety answering point and general public safety rates authorized under Indiana Code 63.668 without changing other components of the expenditure rate or the expenditure rate overall. With adoption of the ordinance, the tax rate for the PSAP would decrease to 0.0594%, representing 23.76% of the total, and the tax rate for the public safety would increase to 0.1906%, representing 76.24% of the total.
Council Administrator Attorney Stephen Lucas said this process is completed annually by the Tax Council to allocate appropriate funds to general public safety services. He clarified a tax increase would not result from the percent increase.
So the public safety local income tax is estimated to generate just short of $9.5 million. In order for PSAP to get their proposed amount for their budget, the rate needs to be adjusted to 0.0594%. And the remaining revenue that's not allocated to PSAP would be distributed to the four units of government according to a formula set out in statute. So, and just to make it quite clear, this action would not change the overall tax rate. This does not change the amount of money anyone in the public is actually paying overall. This simply adjusts the amounts being allocated for between the dispatch center and general public safety services.
Council member Susan Sandberg stated the reallocation would benefit all of Monroe County. Bolden said the ordinance will take effect on January 1st of 2021.
Indiana's COVID-19 dashboard lacks data from 40% of its schools. Almost 2 months ago, the Indiana State Department of Health announced it would track coronavirus data in schools using a public dashboard. As of Monday, the dashboard showed 2,845 total positive cases since the start of the school year. However, as of this morning, over 1,000 of Indiana's schools have not submitted coronavirus data to the dashboard. Dr. Christina Box, State Health Commissioner, attributed the issue to technical difficulties. She also said the State Department of Health is working to remove duplicate data entries.
Our team is working with schools that have had technical issues or who haven't reported yet to ensure that we get them to access the portal and remove any barriers to providing this information. We're also working on finalizing the list of schools that will need to report their data to remove duplications. As I mentioned last week, that likely will change the denominator. We've had several requests for downloadable data or a spreadsheet of school cases. We are working to compile that and hope to have it available soon. But our primary focus right now is ensuring that we are capturing the data in the first place.
So far, 1,755 total schools submitted data to the dashboard as of this week. This comes after 369 more schools were added to the database in the last week. According to the Associated Press, quote, "Because the reporting by schools is voluntary, the state dashboard numbers won't fully capture cases," end quote. Dr. Box said the state health department may consider making it mandatory for school districts to report data. Schools that have five or fewer positive cases may have their data suppressed to protect privacy. The AP reports this is the case for a majority of schools who have submitted data. Box said even though the state is in stage 5, masks and social distancing are still necessary to limit the spread of coronavirus.
please help us by doing your part to help us avoid a spike of COVID in your county. Keep in mind that our temperatures outside are going to continue to drop and that we're officially in fall, and that is going to make it harder to hold activities outdoors. As people come inside more and the flu season ramps up, we need Hoosiers to be more vigilant about hand washing, social distancing, and wearing masks. I know you're tired of wearing masks and staying apart. We all have pandemic fatigue. But I keep hearing about the cases that could have been prevented if we had just taken these simple precautions. We are in stage 5, but we still need to wear masks and practice social distancing so that we can stay in stage 5. I cannot emphasize that enough. Remember that even in stage 5, we still require social distancing and wearing masks indoors. COVID-19 isn't going away anytime soon, and it will be months before we have a COVID vaccine that is widely available to the general public. So let's use the tools that we have right now to keep our state open and keep Hoosiers healthy.
Box said as more schools begin to submit data, the total number of positive cases in schools is likely to increase.
Up next, WFHB correspondent Aaron Comforti follows up with a story he did yesterday about disturbing reports at the Monroe County Correctional Center.
Content warning for sensitive listeners. The following story contains information on self-harm.
According to an eyewitness report and a Facebook thread that included a post from Monroe County Councilmember Jeff McKim, an inmate at the jail in downtown Bloomington named Alan Montgomery attempted to take his own life and was subsequently brought to the IU Health Bloomington Hospital on Tuesday. That's less than a week after Bloomington police arrested him and brought him to the jail, according to the jail's records. I spoke with Alan's mother this afternoon, and she had questions about why Alan missed his court date at 10:30 that morning and why he wasn't brought to the hospital until after noon.
Why didn't they get him to the hospital before noon? Because his court was at 10:30 in the morning on Tuesday. They didn't get him, and it was canceled. I heard he didn't even show up at 7:45 for his video that they had before court at 7:45 in the morning. Why didn't they get him to the hospital before noon? Because when he arrived, his heart wasn't beating. He wasn't breathing. Why didn't they get him there before noon? The hospital's been trying to get a hold of me ever since he's been in there. The police give...
3 days.
Since Tuesday
this
morning
is the third
at
day.
Noon. The police give him my phone number, which is the phone number they took from me. And they knew that.
Oh, they took her phone and they gave them that phone number.
And the police knew that because I told Officer Badge Number 1503, I told him that he has taken my only phone. And that's the phone number that they give the hospital. And the hospital has been trying to get a hold of me ever since he's been in there.
So you went to the hospital?
I went to the hospital last night, yes, sir.
And they sent you to the ER?
Yeah, because front desk didn't know nothing. So I had to go to the ER to find out any information about him. He is on the third floor in CBU unit, the heart unit, because his heart's still not beating. Said the bleeding in his stomach somewhere inside of him, she didn't specifically say where, was probably caused from the cops of giving him CPR, trying to resuscitate him. She said when they brought him in to the hospital, his heart wasn't beating. He wasn't breathing on his own. He don't have no brain waves.
And who told you that?
Bloomington Hospital.
The hospital.
His nurse. I don't remember what her name was, but I talked to his nurse this morning. And he's more or less on life support.
The lack of clear information coming from the jail continues to be a source of confusion for Tina as she continues to hear information from family and community members.
I thought someone who got released from jail...
I don't know that person's name.
Okay.
It was just a friend of a friend that told me.
An inmate that had gotten out.
Yeah.
That morning.
Yeah.
And seen him. And seen them working on him.
Seen him trying to resuscitate him. And then they blocked him and He didn't know whether they resuscitated him or not. And obviously, evidently, they didn't, because he still wasn't breathing or his heart wasn't beating when he got to the hospital at noon. And he'd had to been there and laying there at that jail for 2 hours for them to cancel court. His court was at 10:30 that morning. They didn't get him to the hospital until noon. So how long did they leave him laying there? How long did they leave him hang before they got to? Ain't they supposed to be video cameras in them jail cells? Ain't they supposed to be watching them inmates? Same way my cousin JR. They let him hang for hours.
I reached Sergeant Patton at the jail this afternoon and asked him to confirm some of the statements he had made to me earlier in the morning when we had spoken by phone.
I asked you if you had any information on Alan Montgomery, and what I have written down that you said was, all I know is there's an investigation on that, sir. I wasn't even here that day, so I couldn't honestly give you an honest answer. And I wanted to make sure that's
correct.
Okay, so that means we know there's an investigation on Alan Montgomery, but we're not sure we're not privy to the information about whether it has to do with the reports of the attempted suicide.
Yeah, I don't know what the investigation is on. All I know is it's an investigation.
There is so much more to report on this developing story, and we will continue to do so. For WFHB, I'm Aaron Comforti.
Now it's time for your feature reports. We have an excerpt from last week's episode of Interchange, titled Draining the Heartland, Authoritarian Populism in Rural America. WFHB's Brady Heberlin spoke with Mark Elderman, an anthropology professor and affiliate of the Graduate Center at Hunter College in New York City, about the hollowing out of rural America and the rise of authoritarian populism.
And many people think that people in poor, white, predominantly white communities and people in urban black communities, for example, actually should have a lot in common to fight for. Both populations have been, you know, intensely abandoned by capital. But it seems like this differentiation and these political polls have very much been produced in order to win electoral results, in order to, for example, divide labor organizing. That's been sort of this long process. Can you say a little bit about the history of this differentiation, this sort of pulling apart of people in poverty, whether it's rural communities, urban communities?
I mean, this is an old story. It's the biggest and most successful game that the dominant groups, that the capitalist class has used to divide working people. And it goes back a very long time, certainly to the period of slavery, to the period of Reconstruction following the Civil War, and very intensely in that period of reaction that follows Reconstruction into, say, the 1920s. I think of the old Bob Dylan song about the poor white in the South and saying he's only a pawn in their game. And that's exactly the sad and unfortunate truth, that people that do have many shared interests are being in some ways talked to in a way that really there is some kind of fundamental difference, and that they have to fight each other rather than their actual class enemies. And you mentioned that this is a sort of tension and a difference that is actively produced. It's very much actively produced every day in many, many different ways. And one of the big manifestations, and I write about this a little bit in the Jacobin article and in the other more academic article you mentioned, is that there's been a very intense process, particularly in small towns and rural areas, of downward mobility among a sector of the white population, really among all sectors of the population, but significantly among the white population. And the way in which people process this a lot of the time is a sense of being aggrieved. that I'm entitled to something better. And here I am scrambling, working two or three jobs, or perhaps not being able to find work, living in a community that has been taken apart by forces that I don't understand, but I can be led to understand as being the fault of somebody else. This creates a sense of grievance. It's very, very powerful. One of the things I argue in these articles is that we can't separate out the economic disaster that has befallen so many small towns and rural areas from the racism that some people insist is characteristic of at least a sector of Trump supporters, because the economic stress that people are feeling so much of the time, and it's economic stress from low wages, from indebtedness, from all of these different forces. The economic stress, and there's a big body of psychological research literature that shows this, gives people a greater propensity to be suspicious of or even to hate an out-group, okay? And that out-group could be immigrants, it could be people who are racialized or ethnically different, it could be any number of other groups, but the racial piece of that is huge. And it connects also to notions of masculinity and patriarchy and to the impossibility that many, particularly young, but also middle-aged and older men feel that they have not been able to be adequate providers for their families. And this creates a sense of very intense anger that is easily channeled by demagogues.
One of the tasks that you're taking up in both of your pieces then is to historicize and articulate what is happening systemically that we can attribute some of these grievances to. And you note how hedge and pension funds, private equity shops have effectively emptied out local wealth. And so maybe this is one of the things that people who are feeling this abandonment but can't quite pin what kind of factors are at play are actually sensing. But you note that mutual savings banks, local mom and pop shops, and credit unions had a very different relationship with people in rural communities, and especially farmers, that maybe, you know, predates this sort of sense of abandonment. What would you say is different now, and how does that contribute to the destabilization of rural communities and the sort of sense of abandonment that people, especially in these far hinterlands, are feeling?
Well, that's really the key question, and it has so many dimensions that it's a little difficult to know where to begin. But one could begin probably with what happened to banks. There used to be locally owned mutual banks in pretty much every small town, and it was a different bank in every town. And the directors of the bank lived in the town, and they would make loans to small business people, often with a handshake, on the basis of trust and knowing them as neighbors and community members. And they wouldn't check their credit rating or anything a lot of the time. So these banks are sitting there. And then in the 1980s, investor geniuses come up with this idea that you could make a lot of money by turning mutual savings banks, which are owned basically by the depositors, into stock corporations. So the private equity groups go all around the United States, putting little deposits into mutual savings banks all over the place. So you could put $100 in a bank in Connecticut, and you could put $100 in a bank in South Dakota, and so on. And they did this all over the country. And when the initial public offerings would occur prior to the IPO, anybody who had an account there could buy stock at an insider price. You'd put $100 in there, and then all of a sudden you get the news that you can buy stock. Well, you take $10 million or something, and you buy $10 million worth of stock, and it goes up 15 or 20% or more in a couple of months after the initial public offering, and you make a killing. There's no other investment that was that good.
You're listening to Interchange on WFHB. Our show is Draining the Heartland. Brady Heberlin speaks with Mark Edelman on the ways in which capitalism and the financial sector in particular have abandoned rural communities and led to the rise of authoritarian populism in so-called sacrifice zones.
This started to happen big time in the 1980s, accelerated into the 1990s, the directors of these small local mutual banks were complicit in this because they would get the stock bonanza also and could cash out massively. So the banks either get shuttered or sold to big regional chains. And all of a sudden, the small business person with a hardware store or a diner or something on Main Street has more difficulty getting credit that they need. And in many communities, there wasn't a bank anymore. And you get the creation of what The Economist and some other very pro-capitalist sources refer to as banking deserts. So people have nowhere to bank at all. And this set in motion a whole series of very destructive forces that are mostly invisible to the naked eye. Unless you're on the inside of this kind of process, you wouldn't see this happening. You just know that all of a sudden, businesses are having a hard time. They're closing. There's no more bank. You have to cash your check with a payday lender and so on. So it's these kinds of processes that are hard to apprehend or to comprehend that were occurring and that begin this downward spiral in so many communities.
You're noting that the finance capital, the neoliberal policies, that affects every part of social life. In both of your pieces, you note post offices, local newspapers, mom and pop shops, hospitals, schools, nursing homes, libraries, family farms are all facing a sort of consolidation at the hand of the financial sector, or they just close. And some people, especially with schools, for example, argue that that's a good thing, that we're seeing these institutions take on an economy of scale. But you're suggesting that this is much more pernicious and detrimental to small and especially rural communities?
There's definitely an effect on rural communities. It's very severe. And talking about that, I don't want to minimize the impact on many urban communities, too, because you have sacrifice zones that exist in New York City, very close to where I live, and in Los Angeles and in Chicago and many other big cities. I think the key thing is that these financial actors, particularly since the 1980s, look for anything that they can skim off. And they're very imaginative in terms of how to make money out of things that, you know, a normal person would look at and it wouldn't occur to us that, wow, you can make money off of that. And the example that I develop a little bit in the papers is the example of trailer parks. Okay. Trailer parks are the quintessential home of, you know, the poorest of the poor, often the white poor, but not only. And 6% of the U.S. population lives in a mobile home or trailer, which is maybe not a huge amount, but it's like tens of millions of people. And in rural areas, of course, it's more than 6%. Outside investors found that trailer parks were actually a fantastic investment. And when I started looking into this, I found that there were financial whizzes who left Goldman Sachs to go and invest in trailer parks. And there's a huge consolidation in the ownership of trailer parks. And there's a partnership of a couple of guys who run what they call a mobile home university that teaches other people how to get in on this. And they claim to own $500 million worth of trailer parks. So what do? They go in there, and most trailer parks were sort of mom and pop type businesses, locally owned. They buy them out. If there's a swimming pool, they close the swimming pool because then you don't have to carry a liability insurance policy. They raise everybody's rent by $20. And, you know, when you're doing that on a massive scale, you're generating quite a big cash flow. And the costs are minimal. The administrative costs and the costs of physical plant and so on. It's another one of these investment practices that can generate apparently 20% a year, which is pretty outstanding from the point of view of private equity and hedge fund and so on. And you get the really big actors moving into that. And Main Streets, on the famous Main Streets of American small towns and small cities, it used to be that there was a diversified economy of small retail businesses, mostly locally owned, not all of them probably. And we've seen a succession of things occur with the opening of big box stores and malls. Main Streets declined. And then when the financial geniuses started to engage in leveraged buyouts of all these different chains and so on that are in the malls and of the malls themselves, the malls started to go belly up. You know, it was a huge bonanza for e-commerce and particularly for Amazon, which increasingly has a kind of monopoly and monopsony power that, you know, is unprecedented in U.S. history, where monopolies have historically been very, very powerful.